Welcome to the New Growth Podcast with Nikki Walton. Join her as she explores divine love as a key to spiritual growth, empowered service, and inner and outer success. If you'd like to support Nikki's podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Nikki.
Welcome back to New Growth. After you get done listening to this episode, I would love for you to check out my other podcast, Good Mornings with Curly Nikki, also known as God Mornings with Curly Nikki, available on Apple Podcasts. Please listen, subscribe, leave a review, and you can start waking up with me, waking up as love every single day of the week. Monday through Friday, I drop a new episode, and each one consists of a different spiritual practice, what I like to call easy access doors into this truth, into this oneness. And so we're just practicing love every morning until, you know, we recognize that we never had to practice it, that we are it. So check it out. Check it out. Join me every morning, every good morning, every God morning. Good mornings with Curly Nikki. I'll see you there. First of all, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It is truly an honor. I'm not a cool kid, so I would not have known who you were. I don't watch TV. I don't do anything besides read and pray and meditate. But I have a cool friend that lives in London, and he is a huge fan, and he told me all about you. And I got to be the cool kid for a minute because I'm like, well, kind of like indirectly affiliated because of Ram Dass. So I'm like, I'll DM him for you on your behalf, get his email so that you can send him a love note. And wow, he did, cool. But we would not have been connected if it wasn't for him. You know, just wow. Kind of saying like, you know, I really love his work. I love his approach to spirituality. Without him, it would not have happened. Hey, James, I know you're watching. I know you're listening. He already heard our other podcast, you know.
Hi, James. Thanks for introducing us.
Yeah. So it's so cool. So thankful how all of this works. But the way I start every episode is to hear from you how you experience the present moment, like how you're experiencing this now, right now.
This exact moment?
This exact now.
This exact now. Okay, so slightly cold because I can't go to my studio because my entire family's sick. So right now I'm in my basement. I feel good. I feel really good. You know, a little tired. Yeah. It's been a rough week because I've, you know, dealing with the entire family getting COVID and, you know, also wow. Just trying to support my wife who's, you know, has with COVID been taking great care of the kids, but also going wow. through the emotional, not that I'm not, but, you know, I think in a relationship, you have to take certain roles on and both of us can't be like incredibly deeply hyper emotional worrying mm-hmm, over the kids. Mm-hmm. Like someone's got to be like, it'll be fine. Even though inside,
yeah, exactly,
there have been
exactly.
moments where I'm like, holy shit, it's the fucking apocalypse.
It's scary. My daughter yeah. had it first week of school, you know, and I was wavering between, oh my God, this is terrible, and back yeah. to everything's fine. And, you right. know, this is okay. I can be this rock. I can be solid for her. But it's that fear comes in. It knocks hard.
Sure. Yes, yeah. it does. Because especially, you know, with other colds and sicknesses, you kind of know what's going to happen. But COVID has that element of like, it just can take a left turn for right. some people. Not really for kids. And yeah. what they're saying about Omicron, which I'm assuming they all have, is it's not quite as terrible as other yeah. versions of COVID, like the one I got, Delta. But still, yeah, it's scary to be a parent, no matter what.
Wow, so you've had it too. Goodness, your whole household. So how are they doing right now?
Everyone's great. Everyone's fine. No symptoms. Everyone's fine.
Good. That makes me smile on the inside, from the inside out. So I want you to share with my audience who might be filled with some not so cool kids too. First of all, your journey into spirituality. You are a very famous man. You are very worldly successful. You are a stand-up comedian. You tour. You have this yes. fabulous podcast that you invited me to and I felt so honored to be on.
Thank you for being on.
You are
I used to watch Adult Swim, like when I was still watching TV. And if I was still a TV watcher, your content would be what I would consume, you know, like that late night, like funny cartoon. Like I love cartoons that are for adults. Thanks. Tell us about your journey into spirituality and how you got all the way up to Midnight Gospel.
So it's, I guess it's hard to answer the first question in any kind of like coherent way. I bet you know what I'm talking about. It's just when you sort of think back to how did I get into this stuff, or what even is this stuff that I'm into, or who is even the thing that's into the stuff, you know? And at some point you might even get to a place where you're like, I don't know if I've started the journey yet. You know, I think,
I like that. Who is the thing that's into the stuff? That's great. That's the end of the interview. So that's all. Thank you all so much for tuning in. What are we doing here? What is any of this?
Who's the thing? As far as the Midnight Gospel and my podcast, I just, you know, there was a time when people didn't know what a podcast was. And I remember someone invited me to do their podcast in LA, and I just thought it was really fun and an interesting medium to have a conversation, like the sort of the way that having microphones in front of you when you're chatting with someone transforms the energy. It's really interesting. It focuses the energy in this really beautiful way. So I like that. And then my partner at the time and I started a podcast called The Lavender Hour. Mm-hmm. And then after we split up, I changed the name of the podcast to, you know, it was a new podcast, the Duckett Trussell Family Hour. And I, at some point, got an email from Pendleton Ward, who created this show called Adventure Time, saying that he really liked my podcast. And I thought it was a catfish or something, you know, just someone messing with me. Because I couldn't imagine that I didn't understand, you know, this was still kind of early on in the podcast era. And Then Pendleton and I became friends, and at some point over the years, he said, I think I have an idea for a way to turn your podcast into a cartoon. And I was like, all right, let's do it. And the first time when he mentioned that to me, he said, you know, I'm too busy right now. I don't think that I have time to do it. And then a year or two later, he reached out to me and said, hey, let's do this idea. And so, because it was Pendleton, and because he really is a genius, an incredible artist, we were able to get Netflix interested in the idea, and they let us make the show, and that's how it happened.
Wow. So Pendleton was listening. Pendleton, I'm sorry, I'm going to have them edit that out. Pendleton was listening to your podcast. What was it that drew him in? Like, which topics was it that had him listening in every week?
The spirituality. He liked the spirituality stuff, and he liked that I he liked that I was just sort of, you know, being very honest about what was going on in my life and not tiptoeing around whatever it was that was going through my head in those days.
The transparency.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
And that so that's mixed what I in want. With the spiritual stuff. I think he liked that.
With the spiritual stuff, yeah. I want to hear how Duncan got into spirituality. Like, what turning point, like, what happened in your life where you ended up here? And I know it's hard to figure that out. We all have some form of a story we can piece together. Like, what turned you to this?
Well, I think the first real encounter with it was this book. My mom had all these books around, and one of them was called Raja Yoga by Yogi Ramacharaka, who, by the way, is not even his name. He invented the name for himself to sell books. His real name, he's an English occultist who was putting these like books out, and you know, which is still, I don't care what his name is, but he knew he was not going to sell as many yoga books with a name like James Williams, Terrence Frenchley, or whatever his name was. So he called himself Yogi Ramacharaka. Anyway, I remember opening the book, I liked the book because it had a really interesting cover. I think there was a circle with a, it had some kind of symbol on the book that seemed mystical to me. And so then I just started reading. The good news is in the book, he had put a lot of, you know, basic yogic ideas in there that I had never really heard of. And I can remember that was what compelled me to try to like meditate for the first time, which I just couldn't do. And I remember trying to tell my brother, like, try to sit still for 2 or 3 minutes. It's crazy.
It's crazy. It's impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible. but I, you know, I think that was the very first encounter with it that I had. And then
so your mom was into it. Was she meditating regularly? Had you seen her seated or, you know, trying to do any of the practices?
She wasn't doing that practice, but she was definitely doing early in those days. She was beginning a real path, and I think for her that meant a lot of contemplation, journaling, and reading these books.
Yeah,
you know, single mom, two kids that weren't exactly well behaved. You know, so I think she was really going through it in those days, and those books and ideas were really useful to her to not go completely nuts.
Yes.
You know, but that, so that, she started listening to Ram Dass actually on these trips that we would take to visit my grandmother in Georgia. And so on the way there, she would play these Ram Dass tapes and I would pretend to, you know, be embarrassed by them or hate them or I'd just roll my eyes and be like, whatever. Or she played Jack Kornfield, who she had a crush on. And I would just be like, oh, mom, come on. You know, at the time she was dating new age guys. I really pretended to reject it, but I loved Ram Dass's voice and I loved the stories that he was telling. And I think those were all these like seeds that just started growing in me later on down the line, you know, but it's hard to say exactly when. Again, I really mean like I know I love to read Buddhist scripture and I love, like right now I'm listening to this wonderful audiobook by Pema Chodron, but every time I listen... let me look. I listen to so many of these damn things.
I know, me too. I never even know titles.
I don't know the titles. I just know the authors.
Sometimes don't even know the author.
Yeah, this one is Start Where You Are, Pema Chodron. And it is, oh my God, it's so good. And it's, you know, what I've heard, I don't remember, again, I don't remember where any of this stuff comes from, but in one of these Buddhist books I was reading, it was talking about reading and study and practice like the two wings of a bird. And you need both, you know. You having a practice is great, but, you know, and you do know because you have a very serious, rigorous spiritual discipline, but you know that stuff comes up during that practice that you can't necessarily just go to anyone and mention it to because it's, some of it's very subtle, some of it's very weird, some of it's just like very slight, you know, questions about posture maybe or whatever's coming up. And so I love when I'm doing when I have a sitting practice and I'm also listening to a teacher or working with my teacher, the two work so nicely together. Yeah. But I don't know. To answer your question, I don't know. I don't know. I whenever I listen to people like Pema Chodron, I really do think, I think I'm just starting right now.
Yeah.
Which is probably why the book is called Start Where You Are.
Exactly. So with your practice today, what does it look like?
Okay. So today the practice looks like service because I'm staying home from work to help out. So that means like letting my wife, who gets up with the kids quite often, letting her sleep in, you know, cooking breakfast for the kids, putting the baby. I've got this cool backpack thing that I put the baby in while I'm cooking breakfast for them, which he really likes, and then listening to Pema Chodron as I'm doing that. And then I'm going to sit today. Mm-hmm. I have my cushions right behind me here.
Nice.
But for me right now, the practice is really, I've been putting a lot of energy into the idea of service. I think that's really why I love this Pema Chodron book so much, because she's talking about something called, oh God, it's got the coolest name. Oh man. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's these sort of sayings that are that you allow yourself to think about after your practice. And these sayings are really cool. One of them being, all dharmas are empty, or, everything is a dream. Mm. And then it keeps getting like, or the best one is, everyone wins, I lose. You know, things like that. That's the first one. The first one is everyone victory to everyone, loss to me. And that's the key, because there are all these phrases about liberation. And so the first, and it's like density or something. So it's dealing with the most dense causes of suffering first, which is like, you know, the desire to be victorious or to win or whatever, conquer. This is the deepest suffering comes from that. And then it sort of gets lighter and lighter and lighter until it starts dismissing itself, you know? Wow. So the sayings are, the next saying after everything is a dream is something along the lines of like, what is the consciousness experiencing the dream? And then liberate that consciousness that is experiencing the dream to the point of every little piece of it is eventually let go of.
Cool. Wow, I've got to get that. And it's on Audible, so that will actually happen. That's beautiful.
Yes, Pema Chodron is incredible.
Wow. So in your service that you're practicing, you know, at least in this last week, when that heaviness comes up and you forget that it is actually like it's not a dream, when you feel that it's real and maybe fear comes to knock on Duncan's door.
Yeah.
How do you meet that?
Oh God, not very well. I mean, I get angry when I'm afraid. It's really rotten. I'm in therapy right now. And so it's working, thank God, because it's not cheap, I'll tell you that. But I learned to react to fear by getting incredibly angry or getting really cold. It's like, because my dad, he had a real temper, and my mom would just completely ice down. And so we don't just get the good stuff from our parents, we get the bad stuff.
Exactly.
So these are my two coping mechanisms. So when I get afraid, I'll either get turned into a fucking robot, which is exactly the last thing anyone in a marriage needs when things are going tough, to be around a Vulcan or something. So I'll get just very like, okay, now we're going to do this. And try not to make any expression. All of it I used to think was because I was like, doing survivalist stuff, because I think I saw on TV this idea of like you shouldn't panic, and to me, not panicking, I instead of realizing what I was doing was like essentially like freezing. I'd made up a story about how I was like survive. This is how you survive. And anyone who was showing emotion during rough moments, specifically my wife, I would be like, this is not how you react to this. But I wouldn't say that. I just get really cold. This came up in therapy. So now when I'm getting afraid and I see the anger coming or that thing, I try to just get really vulnerable and say, it's so embarrassing. Like that hurt my feelings, or I'm scared, or this, you know, all these things, which just, I find to be so unmanlike.
Why do we find them so embarrassing? Like, what is that? I've been trying to figure that out lately. Like, I don't like crying on like a sappy movie. I try to hold back my tears so much because I don't want, even like around like my parents, like I don't want them to see me crying over a movie. I don't know what, why that is.
Well, because you're, you know, we, some of us, we learn, we have, we decide early on when we're kids that we got to survive this thing, this human incarnation. We got to survive. Like, this is no, this is not time to cry. You look around, other people are crying, or maybe probably what happened is when you were crying, somebody in your life said, that's not what we do.
Yep,
this is a time to survive. What are you doing? You got to get it together. And so then, you know, you build all these calluses up around that part of yourself that's incredibly vulnerable. Our entire culture, depending on, you know, probably if you're, as, depending on who you are, you, our culture sort of celebrates this ability to not be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so.
And that's the only way. I was born that way. I cry at the drop of a hat. I cry very often for awesome things. I cry for beauty. I can cry over commercial, you know. I cry over sad things. Like, I cry. And when I get angry, I cry. You know, like it is what it is. When I get scared, I cry. Crying is it, that's it.
I think that's, you know, that's to me, whenever I find myself crying over a commercial or something like that, I usually see that as a good sign. I think the crying and the, and like truly expressing yourself is like really, very courageous as long as you're able to continue to like make decisions and take
like
actions.
Function.
Yeah. As long as you're able to function, it's, you know, it's really quite powerful, you know? And, but it's, you know, for someone who's kind of out of practice in that regard, it definitely makes me feel really like weak and vulnerable and kind of like, ugh, I don't want to like admit how absolutely, like, at one level, how absolutely sensitive I am.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And not in a good way either, you know, not like, you know, a lot of people, they'll like, you know, I'm a sensitive guy. I don't mean it like that. I mean like, oh, like, you know, like a lot of us have like these oozing, gaping wounds inside of us that are like really, that are, aren't, it's not that we're not faking it. Like, there's a reason we figured out all these very like sophisticated defense mechanisms to cover that shit up.
Exactly. Exactly. I'd love to know how you got connected with Ram Dass and friends later on.
Well, so this was actually when I was right as my I was in a long-term relationship that was ending, and I was really depressed, and I had read somewhere that offerings, you know, service is a great way to combat depression. And so I just emailed the Love Server Member Foundation because I loved Be Here Now. And I, you know, I don't know what I had a podcast. So I'm like, I could, you know, y'all should have a podcast. I could show you how to do podcasts.
Service.
I think that was what I,
that's so cool. Some it's always service.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then somewhere in there, I became friends with Raghu. And then, after my mother passed away from breast cancer, I was just so fucked up, man. I was so devastated. And Raghu, I remember he said, okay, I just want you to get up and buy the plane ticket to come to this retreat in Hawaii. You're not going to feel like, he was so smart. Like, he understood exactly where I was at. He's like, don't think about it. Mm. Don't, just do it. And so I remember, like, I was so depressed.
What year was this?
It was really, this was, must have been 2014, I'm guessing.
Okay.
And then, yeah, I got the ticket, went to, this is when the retreats were much smaller than this was, and they weren't, this was at this, like, tiny little yoga, like, hotel resort place called Lemuria or something in Maui. And I remember just, oh my God, I was rolling my eyes at everybody. I thought the whole, I was just like, give me a fucking break. This stuff, just the same stuff I used to do with my mom in the car, except there was Ram Dass. Right. I wasn't rolling my eyes at him, you know, because being around him was an incredibly powerful experience. Just being in the presence of someone like that was just, you know, I could roll my eyes at all the hippies.
I was going to say, it was the culture of everyone around him, but...
Yeah, the culture, exactly. Yeah. Rolling my... Now, you know, this eye-rolling stuff that I was doing, again, it's just all defense mechanisms, you know, because anytime you are around people who have a legitimate practice, you know, and who have found a way to open up to the world... That's going to be a really intense threat to all the work you've done building up your ego. So the answer is roll your eyes and be like, oh, really, love? Okay, I guess we're going to.
Love's the answer, got it.
Yeah, okay, I guess so. Even though you believe all that stuff, you know, it's just judgment is one of the, a great tool if you're of you know, shutting yourself off to love. And, you know, fortunately, the Ram Dass, the satsang around Ram Dass, as you know, they seem to have a kind of incredible patience to them and a recognition of, like, what's underneath all that bullshit, you know? And so that's, and I think that's what Neem Karoli Baba was like, from what I hear, is like he could see right through all that, right? Right into your heart. And it just, in that witnessing your own heart, it just completely blows up the game of, like, you know, trying to control everything and trying to mitigate the, it's a very paradoxical thing when you realize you're sort of in this war, not to, like, have to win victory, but you're in a war to keep love out of your life.
Exactly. Exactly.
What
it's bizarre.
What a dumb war.
It's insane. Exactly. A dumb war.
Yeah.
Tell me what it was like meeting Ram Dass that first time. Were you alone with him? Were there other people in the room? And how did you feel?
So Raghu took me to Ram Dass's house during this retreat that I was at. And I was just, you know, I was paralyzed with, I just couldn't believe it. Sometimes in the world of comedy, you'll meet comics and they'll be like, I wanted to be a comedian since I was five. And I'm always like, I never had that kind of confidence, you know, to be like, oh, I'm gonna get on stage and make people laugh. That's nuts to me. Similarly, you know, trying to process how, like, suddenly I was in, like, Ram Dass's swimming pool with Roshi Joan Halifax and Ram Dass and Raghu, and I'm like, I just couldn't believe, I just couldn't understand it. I still can't. I was really heartbroken over losing my mom and all the years of going through, like, you know, someone, you know, transitioning and you know, knowing that that's coming because she had cancer. And but this, you know, they talk about, I don't understand the concept that well, but they do talk a little bit about it, this idea of, like, Dharma transmission, this kind of non-linguistic sort of a non-linguistic way of cutting through it all, right to the heart. And so every time I tell this story, I tear up. It's so embarrassing. So you know, in that moment, I remember thinking, oh, I think things are going to get better. Because, you know, when someone's dying from cancer, it's years of this shadow. Knowing you're going to lose your mom for years is very, not we're all going to lose our moms, but, you know, when there's a kind of expiration date that's placed on your mom by a doctor. So I, right when I thought that, I looked over at Ram Dass and he had the biggest smile on his face. Like he knew that it had just like that had just popped into my head. Wow. And he goes, like that. And it was like, I don't know. I can't explain it. Like to me in that moment, every single thing he was so great at teaching, it was like he gave that to me in one.
I can feel that. I can feel it. That's beautiful.
It was pretty great. And then he, in this kind of fierce way, he looked at me, he goes, I need to talk to you. I want to talk to you. And so then we were up in his house and he you know, wheeled up to me in the wheelchair and I'm just crying. And I said to him, I wish my mom was here.
Yeah.
And he gets that big smile and he goes, she is here.
Like looking through your eyes, you know, having this moment.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Wow. And he meant it, you know. So anyway, it was a very beautiful moment that I will never forget. And he said to me, and again, you know, when you're with someone, when you're having darshan with someone, as they call it, you know, the articulation of it from me to the world I don't think it can successfully impart what's happening, you know, in that moment. Because, you know, a being like that is going to heal you.
Yeah.
And wouldn't be working with you if they didn't think you were ready or if they didn't think there was some possibility of you being open to it. So what he said to me was, you know, again, this is Ram Dass's teachings, but he said he pointed to his head and he said, we need to get you from here to here. And then he pointed to his heart.
Yeah.
And he goes, we can do that.
Love it.
Yeah. Love it. I think he was right. I think he did. He and lots of people in that community have at least in some maybe not so permanent way managed to get me, I don't know, what's in between your heart and your head? Close to it, like orbiting it or something, take.
I feel like you're, I mean, when I was with you for your show, I could feel that love and I feel it now. It's like having his darshan through you, you know?
Oh,
so
wow.
You definitely, there's that dropping where you can all ride that elevator down, you know, from head to heart. And then it's just the practice for the rest of the life is staying down in the heart because we bounce right back up. I did one of my episodes of New Growth. I was like, pretend like, you know, your heart is the hotel lobby and you lost your card, your key to get back up and you're stuck.
Wow.
You can't go anywhere. And so it's like my whole life is just trying to stay here, like where you are right now. And like all of that and that love, just not stepping out of it. Because when I step out of it, you know, it hurts.
Wow, that's great. That's great that now you've managed to reverse it. Because for me, it's like anytime I pop in there, it's very much like, well, look, I'll just go get another hotel key. It's like,
I know.
I'll get back
go back to the front
room.
Desk. Excuse me. No, just hang out in the lobby. It's cool down here.
Yeah, it is.
Wow. That is so powerful. You know, when you said that sound, I was reading Osho's Book of Secrets recently, and well, not cover to cover, it's like 1,000 pages, but his one practice, a meditation, is lingering on that sound. And he said that's the sound you make when you exhale. And when you're dying, that's the sound. It's like a release, and we die in every moment, just like dropping, letting go. So when you said he looked at you and just said, it's like let go, you know, release, like drop down into the heart, fall down into the heart. And Osho was like, you can use words like Rama and just kind of like, dragging that A out. But if you think about it, Krishna, you know, like Allah, it's like all those ahs, you know, almost there's a lot of names of God that have that ah sound at the end. Yeah. So if we can just stay in that, and I do that sighing, you know, because that action does help you drop. I notice that in meditation, that when I exhale audibly through my mouth, it stirs that love. Yeah. Oh, and Krishna Das, in his book, Chance of a Lifetime, he talks about being with Maharaji. No, being back in Kinshi after Maharaji had passed away and being heartbroken and very upset, but then all of a sudden coming into that big form of Maharaji and feeling love, and how he felt so thankful that as soon as he exhaled, he could feel it even more strongly, like that exhale, that would stir the love.
Yeah.
And he could feel it more strongly. So there is definitely something physically there too for us to use in practice.
Wow. Yeah, right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Yes, exactly. You know, this is the book I'm listening to right now. That is the, she's sort of articulated, she's teaching the practice of meditation that I already do. But, you know, it's everyone has a different way of explaining it. Like, you know, Sharon, like the general instruction in Buddhism is put your attention on your breath. Sharon Salzberg has told me that it actually is rest your attention on your breath.
Yeah.
And then
I like that.
Me too. It's a big difference between placing and resting.
Yeah.
And then what Pema Chodron and her instruction, it's 25% awareness on the out breath, and not on the in breath, but that out breath, of course, is that.
Yeah, I love
so,
that.
Yeah. Me too. I love all the. It's, you know, this is the other cool thing about having a practice and being able to have some reference point in your own sitting meditation, is noticing how just a slight shift in the way we think about the specifics of our practice can have a huge impact.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because placing attention on the breath, you can end up becoming too rigid and fixated on the breath.
It's a doing. Right?
Yeah. Now you're exerting.
Yeah.
Whereas, and in that exertion, you know, you're crystallizing your identity in that. It gives you another sort of hideout or
exactly.
something where you could still be a thing.
Yeah. You're the breather. I'm breathing. Or there's breath happening. There's an awareness of breath happening, you know, and then the resting, abiding in the awareness of that breath happening. You're noticing breath. It's a huge difference from I'm focused on breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, I heard on YouTube, you know, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, all these great lectures, and the way he put it is, you know, someone comes home from work and sits down on the couch and goes, and he said, this is, you could compare this to enlightenment, except enlightenment is that, except it doesn't stop. It's just.
That's it.
Yeah, it's cool.
The end.
Yeah. It's something like that. But I like, you know, that having some, like Trungpa Rinpoche, he talks about demythologizing enlightenment. Don't make such a big deal out of it. And it seems like Pema Chodron is kind of saying the same thing, which is like, we're all caught up in like this big deal thing. But those little moments, maybe every time we find ourselves going, that's a little enlightenment. That's a little tiny taste of it, a moment where we become who we really are.
Oh, that's gorgeous. That's a quote right there. Put it in the book.
Put that one in the book.
So I want to talk about confidence. You mentioned that word earlier, and I know it's something that I've struggled with, and I know a lot of people that have written to me struggle with that. You are a whole stand-up comedian. Tell me how you found like your power and were able like to stand in it on stage in front of people like with that.
Well, I mean, this is what's so cool about stand-up comedy is that when you start doing comedy, probably 100% actually, unless you're a mutant or something, when you start doing comedy, you're just not going to be you can't be that good at it. It takes a long time to get good at stand-up comedy. Or by good, I mean, well, you basically like go through these phases, and you'll have comics that you love, and so it's not like you steal their material, but you'll try to like kind of like be like them or yeah. something, because that's what you're influenced by. Yeah. Everyone does it when they're, you know, learning how to do an art form. I've even heard stories of authors typing, like copying an entire book that they like, just to feel what it was like to write the
wow.
book. Yeah, of another author, just to wow. feel the, you know, I think there's something silly about it in the sense that, you know, any final form of a book has like been gone through many hands and been
Absolutely.
Revised many times, but
yeah.
still, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what ends up happening, well, actually, at the Comedy Store, this is where I learned to do comedy. On the right above the where they sell tickets, the owner of the Comedy Store, Mitzi Shore, had placed a sign for the open micers. Every Sunday they would come in and they'd get 3 minutes, and they'd stand in line forever just to do 3 minutes of stand-up. But the sign said, and she called it potluck, is what she called it, the open mic. Not an open mic, potluck, just because you never know what you're going to get.
Yep.
Who's going to go up?
That's great.
The sign said, for 3 minutes, not to be funny, but to be yourself.
Oh,
and
that's
so,
good.
Yeah, wrapped up in that is, mm-hmm. you know, at least her philosophy of stand-up comedy in general, which is that the sooner you're able on stage to just be you and then tell your jokes versus being someone else yeah. and trying to tell stories, the funnier you're going to be. You know, because it already is enough just to be human, I think, you know, mm-hmm. and the situation of, you know, being in front of people talking is already ridiculous. Like, what a silly thing that you've gotten yourself into. What a crazy predicament you're in that you're now in front of a bunch
exactly.
of people. You have to talk to them. It's ridiculous that you should find yourself there. And that's what ends up happening if you pursue comedy and you stick with it long enough. Eventually, you have this sort of the ironic realization that all you needed to do is just be yourself on stage and and you know, you probably would have been okay. Of course, you have to write jokes, which isn't
yeah.
which isn't easy. but both, you know, so yeah, it takes a long time. It takes a very long time. Just like this spirituality stuff sometimes,
yeah.
I think to myself, I don't even know if I've even started yet.
I think it was so powerful when you said, you know, be yourself. And I like completely bought into that for a couple of seconds until my mind came back in and said, who are you though? And because I remember when I was in high school, you know, very awkward and anxious, my mom would be like, just be yourself. And I'm like, I don't know who that is. And I wasn't into spirituality yet. I had a lot of questions yeah. about who I was and why I was here. But I was just trying to fit in and just trying to get along. And I'm like, I don't know what I don't know. All of my personality felt like it was cobbled together from home and movie, like the last movie yeah. I watched and the, you know,
yeah.
friends I had.
Yeah, that's
and
cool.
so that's, I think that's been my whole life too. It's just like, what is this? And so just kind of putting that down, and it seems in that resting, in that abiding in love, that there's still an ego here. It's a spiritual ego. But it feels more myself than what I was trying to do, you know, like in my 20s and early
yeah.
30s.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the, David Nichter, my teacher, will talks sometimes about.
I met him.
He's, right, Maui. That's right.
He was the guitar player.
Yeah, that's right, in Krishnadasa's band, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a relative reality versus absolute reality. Heaven and earth. And mm-hmm. So we're living in a world right now, and we do have personalities, and we do have, you know, ways of expressing ourselves that are unique to us. Where did we get these various ways of expressing ourselves? Probably from imitation, and then refining whatever we imitated into something we call who we are.
Mm.
Is this permanent? unchanging? No, obviously not. It's incredibly transient. And for me, that's always been quite a relief to realize that, so that you don't get, you know, so, you know, sometimes someone might say to you, who are, I don't even know who you are. And you're like, me either. I don't know who I am.
Right. Welcome to the club.
I don't know. Yeah. Exactly. Welcome to my world. How do you think I feel? Right. So that is the quality of us. And I think that it's safe to say that we're all kind of running the same operating system here with maybe different apps,
that
we all have.
That's a good one. So, put that in the book too. Damn.
Okay, I will. I probably do, you know, but that being said, you know, people are running different apps, but from a kind of understanding of ourselves, we can understand everyone else.
Yeah.
And maybe tune into a sort of universal person. My favorite comics, when you see them on stage, that it's not just that they're transmitting like their own experience of life, but I mean, one thing people say is they're saying things I've thought, but I've never said out loud.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that I think once you come to know yourself, you're not just knowing you, you're knowing humanity as a whole, you know? You want to hear a poem real quick?
Of course.
I read this. I just found this poem and it's pretty awesome, but it kind of has this idea in it. It's called Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage by Shi Tao Zi Quan. I don't know. I'm mispronouncing that. I'm sorry. They're dead. Doesn't matter. I'm sorry to anyone. I don't think they would care. They were a Zen monk. But this is about meditation. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When the hut was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly, not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, she doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 feet square, an old man illumines form and their nature. A Mahayana bodhisattva trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west, firmly based on steadiness. It can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines, jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus, this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? Turn around the light to shine within. Then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers. Be familiar with their instruction. Bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. So we get to be the skin bag.
Yay!
Wow.
Let me see that.
This is from this wonderful book called Cultivating the Empty Field. It's really great.
I need to make a note of
and,
that.
Yeah, it's a good one. The Silent Illumination of Zen Master Hong Zi. I really love this book.
All I could feel while you were reading was like omnipresence. Like it doesn't go anywhere. It can't go anywhere. Undying.
It can't go anywhere. You can't lose it and you can't gain it. Mm. That's what pisses us off.
Exactly.
It's like if we could lose it, then we could feel ashamed about losing right. it. And also we could be like, look, I lost it. That's why I'm an asshole. But if we could gain it, then we could feel like I got it and yep. you didn't. Yep. And then we could feel superior. But because of it's this thing that you can't really have
exactly.
or lose, it's quite frustrating to the personality.
Right. The mind can't take it.
It's pretty brutal on one level, yeah.
Ah, so beautiful. I love you. Thank you.
Love you.
Thank you so
Thank you.
Much. Thank you. Can you tell us what's coming up with you, like for you, how we can support you, where we can find you?
Yes. Thanks for asking. I have a podcast called the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. And I'm going to be in Nashville doing stand-up comedy the weekend after Valentine's Day. So if you happen to live in the South, come see me perform.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you again for joining me on New Growth, joining us. I hope to see you again soon.